Sunday, 4th December, 1983.
The usual conception of freedom is to be able to do what you like. This is the very negation of true freedom. True freedom begins at the peak point of self-restraint. A self-restraint which is not brought about forcibly by suppressing and repressing oneself, but by being free of all acceptance and rejection. We accept that which we like, which pleases us, which we approve of, which supports and promotes our particular interest, and we reject the opposite of these things. But so long as we do that, we are always in a state of conflict against that which we have rejected, whether that conflict be positive or implied. But it is there. So, in order that we can realize a total relationship with life in its wholeness, it is necessary to be free of both acceptance and rejection. Because, after all, we live in a universe. In one total reality includes us. And to be in harmony with that total reality is one of the supreme purposes of our human existence as such. And if we are free of all sources of conflict, all sources of things which make us exclude something in that totality, if we are free of that, then one can live as the true human being. Remember, the human being is the happy creator. That's its fundamental meaning, which of course you'll never find in the dictionary or in ordinary philosophies and so forth. Man, the root of it is man, which means not merely to think, but to create. And the hu, the prefix hu, is the means happy, that which has been done well, that which has come to fruition. So the human is truly the happy creator. And in order that we may realize that state of the happy creator, we must of necessity be in harmony with the totality as such, the whole of life, not any part of it. Now, when the mind, I should rather say, when the psyche is utterly free in that sense, then the situation is such that we can really discover the truth. If we take sides in any situation, anywhere, we cannot discover the truth of the whole thing. We are always concerned with that which is our particular interest as against the interest of the other party. That is the reason why all these conferences are failures ever since the beginning of time. Because each party approaches the conference table with the idea that we will get the best for ourselves, and the getting the best for ourselves means something at the expense of the other. If we are concerned with the whole, with the totality as such, then there's no situation of conflict, of disharmony. So, in that situation, the human being becomes conscious of the truth as such. And note, becoming conscious of the truth is very, very different from having some ideas about the truth. The truth is indescribable, actually. But consciousness which is the unknown element in us. We don't know what consciousness is actually, except when it functions in us and we are aware of that functioning. When we become conscious of the truth, then that truth inevitably and naturally, spontaneously, finds expression in throughout our whole life and affects our whole environment. Now, in relation to religion and the religious life, which is what we are really concerned with, all the religions had their founders. And not only their founders, but other great spiritual teachers who were the product of that particular religion, wherever it flourished. And they gave great teachings. Now, the tendency of the followers, the devotees of that religion, is to regard the teacher as absolutely perfect. There is no doubt whatsoever, in my mind anyway, that all the great spiritual teachers were holy men. They were perfected holy men, which means that in them the psyche was utterly pure, utterly clean, so that mind, which is a transcendent energy, functioned freely through their psyche. They were receptive to the truth in the supreme sense, and therefore, as far as the living of the good life was concerned, the good life which brings about the purification of the whole psyche, what they said was truth. But apart from that, we must not think that any of the founders of the religions or any of the spiritual teachers or philosophers or anybody whatsoever in the world was infallible with respect to all other things. They made lots of mistakes in what they said. Now, this sounds very heretical. Yes, indeed it is heretical. And I am a heretic by nature, you see. But the point is this. Think. What were the great founders of the religions themselves? They were heretics with respect to the actual situation in which they flourished. They discarded, they showed that the beliefs of the people were not the right beliefs or ideas, and their way of life was an ill way of life. They were regarded as heretics. And there's no getting away from that. All the great founders of the religions were like that. They were heretics. So I don't mind being classed, the 101st class of heretics. Now you see, in which way were they mistaken? When they said things in connection with matters physical, or sometimes when they talked about themselves. Oh dear, sorry. Here in this discourse, in the third volume of the Digha Nikaya, the Patika Sutta, the Buddha says, "The ultimate beginnings of things I know, and I know not only that, but more than that." How do you know more than the ultimate? You see, statements like that are difficult statements, aren't they? This is what the followers wrote down afterwards, when the Nikayas were compiled, and did not challenge a statement like that. Then again, he goes on, And while I know that, the ultimate beginning of all things, I, even of myself, have understood that peace, realizing which a Tathagata, a Buddha, can fall into no error. He says, can fall into no error. Now listen, in another discourse, he says, after exhorting the people to live good lives, so they will practice these virtues. And because of the good they do, they will increase in length of life, in comeliness, so that the sons of them who lived 20 years will come to live 40 years, and the sons of these sons will come to live 80 years, their sons to 160, their sons to 320, their sons to 640, their sons to 2,000, and he goes on like that up to 80,000 years. I ask you. Now, what does such a thing mean? I mean, you can convert it into an allegory or manufacture a meaning. Why does the devotee manufacture a meaning to satisfy his own sense of security and faith in the teacher? Why does he do that? Because he is not prepared to see what is truth. Has anyone seen an 80,000-year-old man? Or will see? And we know, as a matter of fact, that in the very, very early millennia, people lived rather short lives. I mean, the work of scientists digging up the skulls of children and grown-ups and so on, and being able to date them approximately at least, you see, shows that the span of life nowadays is much better than, much bigger than the span of life in those early days. So that sort of statement is, again, one of the statements which comes from a person who is fallible in these respects, in these matters. Now, there is the famous explanation of earthquakes. About 3 months before the Buddha died, there was an earthquake. As it is put here, the thunders of heaven burst forth, and the mighty earthquake arose, awful and terrible. And the Buddha's disciple Ananda inquires of the Buddha, what is the cause of an earthquake? And the Buddha says, there are 8 causes of earthquakes. What are the 8? This great earth is established on water, the water on wind, and the wind rests upon space. And at such time, O Ananda, as the mighty winds blow, the waters are shaken by the winds, and by the moving water the earth is shaken. That is the first cause. Now, how does that tally with our modern knowledge of earthquakes? Again, a recluse or Brahmin, now listen to this, this is rather marvelous. A recluse or a Brahmin of great intellectual power, mental power he means, and who has the feelings of his heart well under control, when such a one, by intense meditation on the idea of the minutest portion of earth and on the idea of the widest expanse of water, has succeeded in realizing the comparative value of things, he can make this earth move and tremble and be shaken violently. What does all that mean? That's the second cause, he says. Then, the third to the eighth cause goes like this. Whenever the Bodhisattva descends from the heaven world into the womb of his mother, there is an earthquake. Whenever he reaches supreme and perfect enlightenment, there is an earthquake. Whenever he establishes, founds the kingdom of righteousness, there is an earthquake. And when he deliberately rejects the last portion of his life, then again there is an earthquake, and the final cause is when he completely passes away. Now you see, as the words stand, it seems that he is referring to a real physical earthquake. Now, consider, if the birth, the enlightenment, the progress, and the death of a Buddha is attended with earthquakes, and you know what earthquakes do to human beings, what an extraordinary thing that the Lord of compassion and wisdom, in all the important aspects of his existence on earth, should be attended with such horror for thousands of human beings. And you know, this sort of thing was believed literally by the people, which is of course completely absurd. I'm saying these things in order to suggest that it is necessary for us to be free of the wrong sort of adulation of the teacher. We must keep a completely open mind and investigate for ourselves and reject... Wait a minute. I don't want to use the word reject. And understand the truth as it is. We shall never understand the whole truth of anything. Never. Simply because when understanding grows, then the truth, the absolute truth in itself, recedes further and further. That is what happens. We have to be content with finding an expression of the truth we realize, which is less inadequate and less misleading than the expressions which went before. And that is the best we can do. So we must be free of any adulation, free of beliefs and convictions and all the rest of it, because they hinder the mind from being quite open to whatsoever is new, whatsoever is truer, more profound and deep. Now there are other things too. In all the great religions, we have this absurd picture of heaven and hell. Utterly absurd and ridiculous picture. Starting with Zarathustrianism. Zarathustra was one of the first of the great monotheistic teachers. And in his teaching, it is distinctly declared that the evildoer will have eternal hell after his death, the good doer will have eternal heaven after his death. Now let us ask all the great teachers to answer this question. How is it possible for a finite, limited, mortal, little human being to live such a life of evil deeds and so forth, that, or of good deeds and so forth, which produces an infinite eternal consequence. You see, it's utterly illogical, isn't it? If the energy of the good doer or the evil doer is also infinite, then it can produce an infinite consequence. But since we human beings are so limited, so circumscribed, how can we do anything which can possibly produce an infinite consequence? So you see, teachings like that, these have been believed for thousands of years now, and they have done very, very great harm to human beings. I remember in my own childhood when, with my super inquisitiveness, I used to ask mother all sorts of questions about where did I come from and in relationship to death, because one saw death around one with creatures and all those birds and whatnot. What happens? Do we also die? And yes, we also die. And what will happen to me when I die? If you're a good boy, you'll go to heaven. If you're a bad boy, you'll go to hell. And my word, the torments of hell in all the religions, including Buddhism, have been portrayed in the most terrific way. Absolutely incredible, the torments of hell. Dante's Inferno, for instance, as far as Christianity is concerned. Or take the frescoes on the walls of Buddhist temples. I have seen them myself in Sri Lanka, you see, portraying the torments of hell. Now you see, as a child, this produces tremendous fear. I've got to be good in order to, when I'm dead, to go to heaven. Otherwise I shall be tormented forever and ever for the petty little mischief that I do as a little child. And see, this sort of thing is utterly evil. And yet it was promulgated by the teachers of great religions. I'm not saying this in order to denigrate the great teachers or to upset your faith in them. I have complete faith in the holiness of the great teachers. They were perfected holy men, and I have complete faith in what they taught with respect to living the good life, purifying the psyche and the body with it, you see. That, of course, it is in that respect that they were omniscient. But in other respects, not. They were quite fallible. How does this fallibility arise? When the teacher realizes in the profoundest states of consciousness that transcendent condition where he is conscious in terms of infinity and eternity, the supreme reality, when he comes back to ordinary consciousness, which is conditioned all the time whilst we live through the operation of our senses and sense impressions and the activity of the brain. We must bear that in mind, that here and now in the world, that is how they function, just as you and I function. The difference is that because they have purified themselves, conditions of life around them do not make them do the evil things that ordinary men and women do throughout the world. In that respect, they are different. They live a pure life here and now. But as regards knowing, having knowledge of various phenomena and procedures and so on, they are fallible just as much as we are, you see. There is another very difficult and interesting point. The problem of good and evil. all the theistic religions talk of God. The Buddha talked of the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. That was his mode of affirmation of transcendence. The Brahmanical Upanishadic mode was in terms of a primordial, supreme, creative energy which brought the whole universe into being and so forth. Right? But no one, no theologian has ever been able to explain how God postulated as all good, all loving, all merciful, all kind, can allow or let evil come into his universe. Now, to add to the difficulty of this problem, Zarathustra definitely said, it's in the Gathas of Zarathustra, which are his own original teachings, that Ahura Mazda, which is the name, which is the Zarathustrian name for God, I'll just say God, that God created two spirits, one which is the good spirit and the other which is the bad spirit. The workings of the good spirit promote life. The workings of the bad spirit bring about the absence of life, ajyaiti. The good spirit, spenta minus, produces life, gaya, and the bad spirit produces ajyaiti, the absence of life. Now, both of these emanate out of the one God. He created these spirits, as it is said. And you got it almost on the right page. Yes. Look, in Deuteronomy, Jehovah is speaking to Moses. See, I have set before thee this day life and good, and death and evil. I have set before thee. And a little further, I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both thou and thy seed may live. Now you see, how does one solve these difficult problems? One has to understand them in a not merely an impersonal but a transpersonal way. We emerge out of the activity of a transcendent creative energy. This creative energy is itself consciousness. It itself is fundamental substance. Substance not in our material sense of this sort of substance and so forth, but that which stands under, which underlies everything. Now, creative energy is always creative. When associated with consciousness, it gives rise to grades of being which we can never see or hear or touch. But in the deep states of consciousness, you can sense those energies functioning consciously on a cosmic scale. That creative energy functioning as consciousness produces all this, and functioning as substance produces this universe with its incredible variety of things. Now, in order to do this, energy just by itself cannot do it. It has to have some aspect contained within its being which challenges, which acts as a complementary opposite. not an irreconcilable opposite, but as a complementary opposite, like a north and a south pole, an up and a down, a backwards and a forwards, and so forth and so forth. Now, this bad spirit, as it is called, is the complement of the good spirit. Because unless there is a challenge, we know in our own lives, unless circumstances are such that they challenge us morally and intellectually, we do not do anything and grow. It is possible to grow only if there is a conflict. What we have to do is so to understand all aspects, so to understand them, that all these different aspects get integrated into one unitary whole. And in that state of integration into the unitary whole, you become conscious of the transcendent reality, the transcendent truth, as such. And in that, man fulfills the purpose of his existence. And by that, one grows into that state where he is a founder of a religion or a great spiritual teacher or something like that. Now, I quoted Zarathustra and from the Old Testament. Shri Krishna, in the Gita, in those marvelous two or three discourses in which he declares what he himself actually is. One of the astonishing things which he says, I am the gambling of the cheat and the splendor of splendid things am I. I am the gambling of the cheat. If one wants to expand that, I am the murdering of the murderer. I am the raping of the rapist, and so forth. You see, the totality contains everything. We, being what we are, constituted as we are conscious in terms of duality. This and that. Up and down. Good and bad, and so forth, you see. We split up the white light of totality into the different colors, and we choose this color or that color as against any other color. That is how our consciousness functions. That is how the mind functions in us. Now we have to transcend that functioning. And that is where the religious life comes in. In this process, of course, the fundamental basis is morality. The perfect ethic. When one fulfills life in terms of the perfect ethic, the intellect undergoes a change. Instead of being the slave of desire, unchallenged, unconsidered desire, instead of being the slave of that, the intellect begins to serve vision and understanding. Vision doesn't come out of mere intellect. There is that in our constitution, in our psychophysical being, in our whole psychophysical being, which is the seed of wisdom. Now that seed begins to sprout if there is the perfect ethic in our life. Truth, goodness, beauty, all these things, you see. Love, and so forth. That seed sprouts, and that wisdom begins to function. And then, the intellect serves to formulate that wisdom in the appropriate conceptual terms and verbal terms, which enables us to live the good life as such. The pure life. And in living that, we understand, we are able to embrace the totality. What did Jesus do when the woman was brought to him? And they wanted to stone, the Jews wanted to stone her to death. And Jesus said, "Let him who is without sin throw the first stone." And no one threw any stone, but they all went away. And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn thee. Go thou and sin no more." See, this is extraordinarily significant. Here was the perfected Holy One who was quite able to include everything within himself. How does one deal with sin? There is that marvelous teaching in Hinduism. Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, drinks the poisoned cup of the world's sorrow to the dregs. He drinks that and transmutes that poison into nectar, the nectar of immortality. You see, nothing can be destroyed. We, out of our inborn ignorance, through our animal ancestry, what we inherit through our animal ancestry, think in terms of striving against evil and overcoming evil. You can't strive against and overcome in the sense of destroying the thing. Nothing in this universe can be destroyed. Nothing whatsoever. It can only be transformed and transmuted. When I say transformed, I'm thinking in terms of making the evil thing less evil. And transmuting, in the scientific sense of the term, a complete change into something altogether new. This is what we can do. Now, one may say, "Oh, this is all very idealistic and airy-fairy. How do you deal with this, that, and the other problem?" Don't deal with the problem. Deal with yourself. The greatest power for good is what you and I actually are. Not what we think, not what we wish to do, and how easily we rush into this society and that organization and this demonstration and that demonstration with the result. What is the result of it all? Pain, misery, and so forth. And what we, in our short-sighted way, say that, at last we obtain the say, the vote for women, and so forth. If men can't use their vote properly and well, is it likely that women will? Or if women can use their vote well, is it likely that men will? Because we are all alike, you know, in nature. We are all alike. We are all different versions of each other. You are a different version of me. I am a different version of you. But we are all just, we have that basic underlying humanity, that humanness. And that humanness has to be inclusive of the totality, not exclusive of anything within the totality. And this is the real significance of the religious life, that is just what the religious life does. It transforms our mode of awareness of existence and of ourself into the transcendent mode. It completely alters our mode of awareness, our consciousness itself. And when that happens, you yourself, by virtue of your actual existence, are a source of energy going out into the world, emanating out of you just naturally and spontaneously, without your making any effort for it, which purifies your whole environment. You know, I've experienced this sort of thing myself. When you go into the presence of somebody who is really the pure one, the holy one, when you go into his presence, you undergo an extraordinary change. Your problems disappear, your questions vanish, you suddenly are transformed altogether. That is what actually happens. I know this in my own experience. And then, if you can use such an experience to your advantage, you can realize that what you actually are is the most powerful influence for good. See, the invisible, the unseen aspect of life is on the whole, far more powerful than the visible aspect. And when consciousness undergoes that kind of transmutation, that invisible aspect functions more and more freely through you. You know how in all the religions, I don't know about all, but certainly in some of the theistic religions, and so was moved by the Spirit of the Lord, or the angel of the Lord. What does this mean? That in your own consciousness, this change has taken place, which seems to you as if the totality, call it God, call it what you like, is functioning easily and freely through you. You are a changed being. And that is perhaps one of the most important things which takes place in the life of the religious. And that is what will really change the world and produce a humanity which is truly human. Today it is just subhuman, as it has been from the beginning of time. It is subhuman. But we can produce a human humanity if we care for it.